Alan Sack, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for calling. I appreciate it.
You say in your book that your college football experience seems quaint compared to today. Of course, commercialism, the money that's involved, is probably the most obvious change between the 1960s when you played and now. But what do you see as other disturbing changes?
In seventh grade, I was out shooting my BB gun in the woods and the fields around my house and dreaming about playing for the Philadelphia Phillies and playing sandlot baseball. Today, the seventh graders have now become recruitable athletes by the NCAA. A change right down to the youth sports level. Kids are starting to prepare for professional sports, and they see education at high school and in the collegiate level as the way they're going to get into professional sports. That's a massive change. I played lots of different sports when I was a kid. Now I see more kids specializing in one sport when they're in eighth grade. So quaint, maybe what I did was quaint, but I think it was in the best interest of my setting my priorities in life and seeing that the real mission of a university was to create well-educated citizens, and that sports was really just a way of rounding out that education.
Even the NCAA likes to say, quote, there are 400,000 student athletes and most are going pro in something other than sports. You're a great example of that. You were drafted for the pros, but chose instead to go to graduate school in sociology at Penn State, where you became interested in the sociology of sports. What inspired you to look more critically at the role of sports, not just in higher education, but in society in general?
Part of it was being at Penn State. I blame, or maybe I should applaud, Penn State during those turbulent years when Martin Luther King was assassinated and Bobby Kennedy and the My Lai Massacre and the Mexico City Olympics. That's when I got to Penn State from Notre Dame to graduate school. And so that time just made me start thinking. My head was just spinning. If you live through that era, like I did and some others did, it's hard to come out of it without thinking hard about a lot of things. And one of the things I started thinking about was, wait a minute, maybe some of the sexism that I see in society and some of the racism I see in society and some of the other problems that we have are in fact reflected in sports. And I think that was a lesson that came out of my Penn State experience. So I saw that sport was simply not an aside, nor was it merely a reflection. It has an effect. It can have political consequences and economic consequences. So to answer your question, I devoted a lot of my scholarship, not all of it, but a lot of it, to looking not just at college sports, but at sports and nationalism and ethnic cleansing in the Balkans as it relates to soccer. That's how I got into this particular topic. And most of my colleagues, and not colleagues, my friends and teammates from Notre Dame back in the 1960s, I still talk with them, but they left the academic environments. They're lawyers, they're attorneys, they're very, very successful people, but they have not been focusing on the issues like I have because I've stayed in the academic realm, and I've seen it happening and developing, and I've studied what's happening.
You mentioned sexism and are disturbed, you say in your book, by female athletes who are modeling their programs after the same commercial models we see in men's sports.
Yeah, the women are still doing very well when I look at the data in terms of graduation rates, doing much better than the men do, and there could be any number of explanations. But I also see a disturbing tendency there toward starting very early in life to try to carve out a career as an athlete rather than really having the attention focused on being a great scholar. Now, one of the things that saves the women, and they would say it's not so good, but I'd say it's probably a good thing, is that professional sports for women has not yet taken off to the same degree as for men. But I would imagine if it does, and it probably will in some time become professional basketball for women and other sports, then you'll start getting the seventh-grade young women trying to do the same thing that men are doing today and just see education as not for primarily traditional education purposes, but as, again, a stepladder into the pros.
You say that the relationship between players and coaches today is more like employer and employee, with coaches being able to fire a recruit who doesn't pan out after 1 year. And you have advocated, it seems to me, for workers' compensation benefits for a student who, for example, suffers a catastrophic injury while playing ball.
Yeah, I think you're hitting on one of the most important, and also perhaps I think it's a subtle argument that it's difficult to make in sound bites. But what I'm really arguing is I've always been a firm advocate of amateurism in the truest sense. That is, I think the Ivies come close to it, and perhaps the Division III schools without athletic scholarships. But as soon as you enter an athletic scholarship into this deal. And certainly when it becomes 1 year renewable, and you can actually take away a scholarship if an athlete does not do what you want them to, you're moving toward more of an employer-employee relationship, because that is defined by common law as having the control over the labor force, being able to tell them how to carry out their duties. My God, in big-time college sports, they tell you how to run, how to breathe, how to lift, what to eat. There's no other occupation in the United States that has more control. Therefore, it is, in fact, employment. If that's the case, then on a given day during the season, and the athletic director is walking through the upper tiers of the stadium and slips on a Coca-Cola can or whatever, and he's paralyzed from, God forbid, from the neck down, the guy's got workers' compensation, or the woman, she's going to get workers' compensation benefits. If at that very same, let's say it's a Michigan game, one of the athletes, one of the football players on the field is, a catastrophic injury of the same sort, from the shoulders down paralyzed, they don't get workers' compensation. And the irony is, some of the payment of the workers' compensation for the athletic director is going to be coming from the money that's being generated by the athlete down on the playing field. For me, I see real problems with this. So my point is, I prefer not to see college athletes as employees, but the National Collegiate Athletics Association, by changing its rules since I played, has turned them into employees. I don't want them to be employees. They've been turned into. And once you do that, you have to give them the rights of employees. I'd much prefer our not having them employees. I just wrote an article for the Inside Higher Education where I laid out a possible way to do that by, of course, doing away with the one-year renewable scholarship. Immediately, the NCAA should say, hey, if a kid is hurt playing sports, they should not lose their scholarship. And they should put that in a rule book. Right now, the NCAA rules allow that to happen, and I think that's unconscionable.
When Miles Brand became the CEO of the NCAA back in 2003, he said that he looked forward to being a change agent. And in fact, a number of people saw him as a tireless advocate for the student athlete. And as you've said before, you've disagreed with him on a number of things, although you respected him. I'm wondering who you would like to see become his successor. And who do you think really has the clout to usher in the kinds of reforms that you think are actually necessary?
I don't think anybody could do it better than Miles Brand. Being the president of the NCAA, I kind of think about Obama. And you come into power and you have all these ideas about what you'd like to accomplish. And you have a lot of things you want to do, but in the end, what do they say? You end up getting sausage because you're trying to placate so many conflicting interests. When I think about it and I think about Miles Brand, he accomplished the academic performance rating, which to me is not enough. You know, it doesn't go far enough. It doesn't really bring back the kind of things I'm looking for in terms of the demands on the athletes academically and otherwise. But the fact that he got it all is kind of miraculous, and it really took a lot of diplomacy on his part. So you need another person. There may be a few people who I would think could move in that direction, but I don't think that the changes I'm looking for are likely to come from the NCAA itself. It is so driven by these powerful interest groups, alumni, corporate executives, people who, state legislators who are opposed to certain kinds of reforms for college sports because they know their constituencies would not be in favor of. So it's hard to change it. If change comes, it might come from the federal government in terms of the Internal Revenue Service, and at a certain point they're going to lose their patience and say, wait a minute, this thing doesn't look like amateur sports at all. It looks like professional sports. And you're making millions of dollars from this, and it's not taxable. What I'd like to see is a congressional hearing, not so that they take away the tax exemption, so that they at least threaten it, so that the NCAA is given an incentive to work a little harder, bring about more deeply, long-standing reforms, more so than what they have right now.
You've been talking about these issues for 30 years. How optimistic are you really of bringing back real amateurism in college sports?
That would note, we do have amateurism in college sports, though. We shouldn't make that error. I do believe that in the schools that have no athletic scholarships, where they have need-based financial aid, where there's a commitment to these athletes as students first, and if they really don't play sports or they don't work out, that doesn't matter because they still have the same financial aid. So, yeah, I think there's already that model still exists, and it does thrive, although it's under attack in those schools, too. The possibility of the rest of like Michigan and Penn State and Notre Dame and the others giving up athletic scholarship, it would take something truly remarkable, like the fall of the Berlin Wall or something. It's just not going to happen in that regard. I think things are more likely to go on as they are now. The changes might come from the athletes themselves as they get more sophisticated, and they're not the kind of changes I think I want to see. If a court case comes along and it actually goes against the NCAA and says, hey, these kids are really professionals, I think that would force the NCAA back to reassess where it's going and try to make the athletes not professional entertainers. And that would mean changes in the way that they handle scholarships, different ways of approaching the academic reforms that have to be done. But there has to be leverage. And you can see I'm struggling right now. 30 years, where is the leverage? There are millions of good ideas, and they're all good ones that I hear. But how do you get them to come to fruition? That takes some kind of a political leverage point. And I don't see it outside of government or maybe the athletes organizing. Faculty don't seem to care that much.
Alan Sack, thanks so much for talking with us. Alan Sack is a professor of management at the University of New Haven. His newest book is Counterfeit Amateurs, published by Penn State Press. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.